Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 25th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Joel Mugg. Today's session number is 98-2, and it's titled Transforming Faith, the Quest for Global Justice Through Liberation Theology. Let's listen in.
So, for the benefits of the folks taping, I think we'll begin. My name is Joel Mugg. Until the end of May, I was the director of the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And during those years, I was very involved in coordination of educational experiences for both student and adult groups in countries all over the world. Tomorrow night I'm going to talk a little bit more about the nature of that kind of work and the experience of travel education. But suffice it to say that the kind of work that we did and which the center continues to do is something different than standard tourism. It's education which takes people deeply into the fabric of societies that they're visiting. And tries to look at, help people understand the complexity of social, political, and economic issues in those societies. During those years, much of our work has been in Latin America. And today, I'm going to be, the title of our session today is Transforming Faith, Global Justice, and Liberation Theology. And what we're going to, the kind of things I want to share today have really been a very, very important part of our work at the center over the last 16 years. As I said, most of our work is in Latin America. Liberation theology has its roots in Latin America, and has provided one of the frameworks for much of the kind of education that we've done over these years. Now, liberation theology is not limited to Latin America. It has emerged in many parts of the world in various forms and various shapes, but almost always growing out of situations where the majority are poor. And as we'll see when we get into a discussion of liberation theology, that one of its characteristics almost is its emergence from the base. And so I wanted to set that context for you because the session that I did on Tuesday, we talked about transformative education. And that really is one of the foundations of the kind of educational work we've done in Latin America. And I would say that liberation theology is the other. The kind of faith perspective that liberation provides and the communities out of which liberation theology has grown have often been the communities that have been hosts for our groups. So let me just sort of plunge into a discussion of liberation theology. Please ask questions at any point along the way. We'll leave some time for questions at the end as well. But don't wait for that if you have a question, if it's not clear what I'm talking about. I want to start with a quote from Camilo Torres. Camilo Torres was a priest turned guerrilla in Colombia and was actually killed by the Colombian military. It's probably been almost 30 years ago now. His quote is this: "In today's world, there is only one way to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, care for the sick and imprisoned, as Christ invites us to do, to change the structures of society which create and multiply every day those conditions." And I think that's a theme that you're going to see throughout our discussion of liberation theology emerging in a lot of different ways. The starting point for those who or live liberation theology is perhaps a better word. The starting point is an awareness of the conditions in which people live on this continent and in many parts of the world. And it's a recognition that the roots of, and that's a situation in which the vast majority of the world lives in situation of poverty. It has a recognition that the roots of those conditions lie in the political and social structures of society. The dependent relationships of third world nations on the developed nations, and to a certain extent on the nature of capitalism itself and our whole global economy. One of the people who's been sort of very formative, not only in liberation theology, but in thinking about our global economy, is a Jesuit scholar named Javier Gorostiaga. He's rector of the Central American University in Managua, Nicaragua, and he's been an advisor to the World Bank and been just a very influential economist from the from Latin America. Gorostiaga talks about that we live in a world that is a champagne glass economy, in which the richest 20% of the world's population has 82.7% of the world's income, while the poorest 20% of the world has 1.4% of the world's income. And he says what we're doing, we're living in a champagne glass economy and a champagne glass civilization, where this civilization is weighted so heavily in terms of the resources for that wealthiest 20%. And one of the things he says is, in terms of glasses, probably the least stable glass is a champagne glass, right? You can tip it over real easily. And especially this one that he says doesn't have a base, right? There's no base on this champagne glass. So we're in a very precarious situation where there's a horrific unequal distribution of wealth in the world. And so that's really one of the starting points for liberation theology. Recognition of this fact in the world. What is missing from other theological systems, say those involved in this approach, is this dominant cultural reality of poverty and oppression. That is one of the primary dynamics in our world. And this kind of dynamic is central to our understanding of how the world is and how the world works. Liberation theology is not so much a new theological system as it is a new way of doing theology, or a new pair of theological glasses. It's a new way to look at theology. And what liberation theology suggests is that we look first at the reality of the world, these kinds of dynamics. That's the first thing we need to look at. And then look at our faith. In other words, let the world teach the theologians, not the other way around. So starting with the dominant political, economic, social realities in the world, one of the primary of which is the nature of our global economy, and then we begin to do theological reflection based on that. Now, another very important aspect of liberation theology is that those who do theology are not the academics and professional religionists, if you will, but the poor themselves. That theology of liberation has emerged from grassroots Christian communities, small groups of Christians who have gathered throughout communities all over the world, often organized by priests and religious workers, but who have provided the foundation of liberation theology from their own experience. Now, many of you may have heard of what are called base Christian communities. And it's an approach that's been utilized or tried in this country as well. Base Christian communities are groups of people, usually who live together in the same community, who come together on a regular basis, usually weekly, to pray, work, share the material and spiritual resources, much as the first Christians did. This was a very important dynamic throughout Latin America and other parts of the world during the 60s, during the 70s and 80s. It was really a new way of evangelism. And it had its root, really came about because of several dynamics. The first was this situation of extreme poverty in which so many of the people in Latin America found themselves. And a recognition that nobody was going to help them get out of this situation if they weren't able to do it themselves. And because of the work of certain key priests and people throughout, and people working in organizations throughout Latin America, people began to come together in small groups to begin to think and reflect about their own situation. The most basic dynamic was this situation of extreme poverty. Related to that was really the determination of the poor to survive, that they were going to survive this situation. A third dynamic was the scarcity of priests in Latin America. There simply were not enough priests to go around to provide the kind of ministry to people that we're more accustomed to in this country. And then, perhaps more instrumental than anything else, in 1968 there was a very important conference of Latin American bishops that took place in Medellin, Colombia. Peggy Leneau is a writer on Latin America who died a few years ago, who described the Medellin conference in the following way. Medellin produced the Magna Carta of today's persecuted, socially committed church, and as such rates as one of the major political events of the century. It shattered the centuries-old alliance of church, military, and the rich elites. Now here's an expert on Latin America calling this Conference of Latin American Bishops, which I assume most of us here, maybe a couple of you have heard of it, but most of us here have not heard of it, right? And who's calling it the Magna Carta, who is calling it one of the most significant political and religious events of the century. And I think, in fact, on a global scale it was, because it really set the tone for a whole way of new way of doing theology and being the church that began in Latin America and that grew, spread throughout the world. The groundwork for Medellin was really laid by the Second Vatican Council, which began the process of legitimizing participation of laity in the church, in the Catholic Church. But the bishops of Medellin, at Medellin, said some very important things that later, many of them were kind of sorry they said, I think, and sort of didn't realize the impact of what they had said, because they really rocked the church. First of all, they condemned corrupt governments and the repression of military regimes. Well, that doesn't sound like such a radical thing to do, except if you remember Latin America in 1968, there were many strong military governments in Latin America, most of them supported by the United States, and their statement was a fairly bold statement at that point in Latin American history. Secondly, they placed responsibility for poverty and misery in Latin America on social and economic structures. This was really one of the first times in this hemisphere that the church began to talk in that way. They placed responsibility on social and economic structures. And they condemned both capitalism and communism as affronts to human dignity. And they placed the blame for social injustice squarely on those with a greater share of the wealth, culture, and power. Top of the champagne glass. They placed the responsibility for that on, for those who have a greater share. And they suggested, and this was perhaps the most dramatic statement, or the most the one that set forth, set loose the change, they suggested that common people, the poor themselves, should be active agents for change. And that was in contrast to centuries of the church's role of helping, quote, helping the poor, right? The church seen in a role of charity. Latin American bishops turned that around and began to say, the poor themselves must be agents for change. Two key words that emerged were liberation and participation, and they placed a great deal of emphasis on liberating education. Now, those of you who were at my session on Tuesday, we talked about a lot about Paulo Freire, who was a very important Brazilian educator. And his educational methodologies were a very important foundation for liberation theology as well, in which he talked about, the poor being the agents for change themselves by forming together in small groups and talking about their own situation. They began to empower themselves for change. So it was out of these dynamics that a new way of doing theology began to emerge. And together with the work of Freire, what happened was the growth of hundreds and even thousands of these base Christian communities throughout Latin America. There might be as few as five or six families, it might be a group of 20, 25 families. They would come together weekly and they start by talking about problems in their community. They might talk about the corruption in their local government, or they might talk about the garbage dump down the street and how they can begin to solve that, or they might talk about health problems in their community. But then they begin to, on the basis of this, they would reflect in the light of Scripture on their situation. And so this emergence of a kind of theology from the base, with a number of Latin American theologians who would really try to take and interpret this theology and put it in, they're the ones who wrote the books and did all that, but it was really, it grew from the grassroots up. The methodology, one of the leading liberation theologians is a Peruvian named Gustavo Gutierrez. And the primary methodology of liberation theology is what Gutierrez and others call praxis. And that means to act in the world, reflect on that action, and then act again. So instead of, I think it's really important that the starting point is the action. Because I think for our traditional understanding of our faith, we sort of reflect first and kind of figure it out, and then we do something. Right? And for all too many of us, we never get to the doing. I think many churches, it's left in the reflection stage. Act, and then reflect on that action in the light of Scripture. Act to transform the world, too. Not just act in any way. Act for change, reflect on that action, and act again. It's an interplay of action and reflection. And it's practice. As Robert McAfee Brown calls praxis, practice becoming aware of itself. In other words, it's not just doing, it's not just serving, but it's becoming aware of the impact of that doing in the light of Scripture. A central motif in liberation theology, and as we get into these, I'm going to go through some of the motifs of liberation theology, and as we get into them, you're going to see why I think liberation theology really became a threat to much of mainline North American Christianity, and is still today. A central motif in liberation theology is that God always takes God's stand unconditionally and passionately on behalf of the lowly, that is the poor and the oppressed, and against the lofty, the rich and the powerful. That God takes sides. Now that's a little threatening, I think, to those of us who may see ourselves sort of in comfortable sectors of society. Poverty is a scandalous fact which must be eliminated. and that God is engaged in the struggle against it. God is clearly and unequivocally on the side of the poor, or at least involved in the struggle against poverty. And that again is a very central theme to liberation theology, that it is not God's will for people to be poor. Also, one finds in the life of Jesus, and I think this reflection on Scripture is not hard to find that, a special affection or even a choice for the poor and those outside of the mainstream. And even more, for liberation theologians, the liberation of the poor is the sign of the presence of the kingdom. So, looking at historically, liberation theologians would look at history and see at those points where we've seen liberation of the poor, or people engaged in that struggle for the poor, we see signs of the presence of a kingdom. A common contemporary figure for many liberation theologians in Latin America was Martin Luther King in our own country. I mean, many of them seeing him as a kind of sign, his work is a sign of God in our own midst. Another central motif in liberation theology is the Exodus story. That Exodus is seen as a corporate liberation event, which is not only spiritual, but political in nature. All right? It's not, it wasn't, the whole event was, just as the Exodus story was God was leading the people of Israel out of Egypt into a new land, God's saving action throughout history is to lead people in the struggle to become free from political oppression and enslavement, and to build a more human society. So that that the political nature, the political liberation that was part of that Exodus story, it was a very important dynamic in that story. And it's really a central motif for liberation theologians. You'll see them returning that to that the story of Exodus again and again. And so any such liberating events are seen as signs of the kingdom of God. Now, together with that, and this whole commitment to the poor, also the liberation theologians suggest that the church cannot remain neutral in the political arena. To remain neutral in any is to participate in oppression. It's to support the status quo. If you're neutral, if you don't take a political stand, then you're supporting the way things are, right? I mean, you're not working for change. And that is, for liberation theologians, to continue to participate in oppression because the status quo is one in which the majority of the world's people are in a situation of poverty and oppression. And so since there is no act that does not have political implications, to not speak out or act is also very political. That makes sense? That you can't not be political. By not acting, you're being just as political as acting.
It's kind of like a statement of Archbishop Desmond
Tutu?
Yeah, Ed mentioned, he says there are no innocent bystanders.
Absolutely, right. There are, everybody hear that? There are no innocent bystanders. A statement by Desmond Tutu. I think that's very much, the tone of what liberation theologians are saying. Yes?
The phrase that has a lot of meaning for me and is very concise and easy to remember is silence gives consent.
Yes, another very good one. Right, absolutely. And I think what was so significant about Medellin, the Medellin conference, is that on all of these issues, the church had largely been silent for centuries. And here was the church, you know, not being silent anymore. And you can see, as you see the natural flow of the conclusions that liberation theologians began to draw, you begin to see why maybe some of these, quote, conservative bishops began to wonder what it was they really said, right? because the whole structure of the church was being challenged. Then it gets even dicier, because for virtually all liberation theologians and the communities that were struggling during the 70s and 80s with these issues, remember our statement, you can't be non-political, right? For virtually all of them, some form of society that mandated a distribution of wealth, a redistribution of wealth, was seen as the goal of the struggle in Latin America. And of course, what does that mean in terms of political structures? But socialism, of some form or another, was basically seen as the goal of the political struggle. And it was seen, socialism was seen as very consistent with the political motifs and the undertones in the life of Jesus. Now, most liberation theologians were clear that one did not have to be a socialist to be a Christian, but they maintained that it was easier for gospel values to be realized within some form of socialism rather than capitalism. Okay? You follow the logic on this, right? That became really the core of the political struggle, and which then began was one of the reasons we saw some of the military struggles that took place in Latin America, especially in Central America, had that sort of goal in mind, some form of socialism as the political goal. And while many liberation theologians rejected sort of a Marxist ideology, they did see Marxism as consistent, or Christianity as consistent with a Marxist analysis of society. That is, the notion of a class struggle as being a very important dynamic within society, and at least that element of Marxism many liberation theologians embraced. That class struggle is reflected in this unequal distribution, right? Now, at the same time, while the church, many were calling for the church to come down in favor of some form of socialism as a political system, it was always attempting, or many at least were saying, that the role of the church is always to call any government to be more fully human. And it was very interesting during the time of the Sandinista government in Nicaragua that, as you can imagine, that this base Christian community movement was a very important dynamic in the emergence of the Sandinistas to power in Nicaragua. Because it grew very much out of a strong base Christian community movement, and the Sandinista project was very much a reflection of what many of these base Christian communities were calling for. But what was very interesting, once the Sandinistas came into power, you also then saw the church providing, while a supportive role generally, that is, the progressive wing of the church in Latin America, you also saw many of these base Christian communities providing some very healthy critique to the Sandinistas. So trying to take that role seriously of calling any government to be more fully human. Now, I think, as many of you know, and it's been the case for some time, but especially during the 70s and 80s, when that was happening, even in many circles, the mention of the word socialism sort of caused cardiac arrest, and especially in our churches. You know, you go to do a Sunday morning forum and talk about the need for socialism, and you're liable to have a mutiny. But I think what the problem was, that the only image we had at that time was the kind of a more repressive totalitarian society, or at least that's the image we had been fed in this country, of represented by governments such as the Soviet Union at that time, and also what we had been taught about and told about a government like Cuba. And what many Latin Americans, theologians among them, were calling for was something entirely new and different, a type of democratic socialism that emerged out of the needs of a particular people at that time in history, and a society that was governed by the logic of increasing justice and equity for all people, rather than maximization of profits. Now, I think those of you, how many of you had an opportunity to travel to Nicaragua in the early 80s, let's say, early to mid 80s? Okay, several of you. And I'd like to hear your reactions to this as well. But I think what we saw in the early years of the Sandinista government was very much this kind of image, or this kind of idea of a democratic socialism, where there was strong grassroots support and grassroots participation, and that there was an excitement about Nicaragua at that time, before the United States really put its millions of dollars into trying to stop that government through its support of the Contra. There was, I think, the possibility of a new model for what socialism could be that was much different from anything we'd see in the world. I'd like to hear from some of you who were there during that time. Do you have some reactions to that or thoughts about that? Do you share that? Anybody like to comment?
I felt there was an excitement among the Christian small groups that I visited, a really excitement of what they saw happening, that truly a new just and democratic society was emerging, coming into view. Actually, I was in Cuba at the same time, and even we talked to the Minister of Education and Church Relations, he had a double role, and he talked about what the goals were, and they were very much these kind of goals. And of course, they felt that the opposition from the United States was what was keeping them back from achieving those goals.
Right.
But an instance, they said their goal was that no one would have an income more than three times the lowest wage earner, and they were really apologetic that it was still like some people were getting six or seven times as much, including the man speaking to us, who was a lawyer who had been privileged previous to that, and he was apologetic that they hadn't gotten any closer to their goal than that.
Goal. Yeah. Any others have any comments, those of you that were there?
As we met with small groups of peasants, essentially, you could sense their pride and their kind of the empowerment that they felt in working together and having a base from which to build a new society.
And I think those really were sort of the living out of this whole approach of base Christian communities, because this sort of personal transformation that took place at the same time consistent with a societal transformation, where people were transformed by the fact that their opinions mattered and their actions had some impact. So it was a very exciting time, I think. Now, some argue, and we're going to get into some of the critiques of liberation theology in a moment, but some would argue that liberation theology, or theology, is being identified with particular ideological roots. But what liberation theologians would say, that is, this particular theology is, but what liberation theologians would say is that no theology is free from ideological roots. I mean, that any theology has in it a certain assumptions about the world, and about that no theology is free from ideological roots. And that the role of theology, or the role, our role, is to try to always unmask those roots and be clear what they are, right? To be clear about what those roots are. Another sort of characteristic of liberation theology is that it tends to eliminate the sacred secular dualism and suggests unity as a point of departure. We don't have liberation on one hand and salvation on the other hand, but they're somehow part of the same reality. Liberation, salvation. love of neighbor and on one hand, and love of Christ on the other hand. I mean, this is, you know, Lutherans especially were pretty good at dualistic thinking, right? But these are the same reality. To love one's neighbor is to love Christ. To love Christ is to love one's neighbor. These are not separate realities.
What impressed me was in the worship, where the people would speak up and give their own day-to-day examples of the Bible readings, and the priest would walk among them. And it was just really exciting because it was concrete theology.
Right, exactly. And these kind of sermons where people would be, the scripture might be read, the priest might say something, but it'd be inviting comments from all over. Very participatory. And I think the connection, again, another point of unity, human solidarity and the sacraments. Human solidarity and the sacraments. Not two separate realities, but one reality. I was really reminded of that last night when Kirk Salveson, who's on the board of Holden, was reflecting on his first trip to Latin America when he was a student in our program in Mexico. And he was reminding me of an incident in Central America, in Nicaragua, where we had gone to church one night at a parish where several of the sons had been killed in the Contra War. And this connection between sacrament and human solidarity. And when the priest had invited us, had introduced us, and was making the welcome to the sacrament, and you know, in most of our churches, especially if we're in most ELCA churches, I think now, is the invitation: if you believe in the accept Jesus Christ, you're welcome to commune. Come to the table. A sort of invitation, being a welcoming, and the priest said his welcome was all who are willing to give their life for their neighbor are welcome at the table. Just as matter of factly as we were to, and it really, you know, I mean, it just cuts right to the core of what does it mean to be with Christ, right? And in that context, in Central America, that was a profound, profound kind of statement, right? And again, the connection between what does it mean to be in solidarity, what's sacramental. And so finally, I think in terms of this notion of unity, that the classical foci of theology are you can't dissolve the relationship to the search for social-political liberation and the building of a new humanity. That you cannot separate that. That it's all one reality. And in this sense, the concept of the kingdom of God or the reign of God, liberation theology still, I think, has a little gender problem at times, is central to liberation theology, this notion of the reign of God. It's not something outside of history, but it's within history. Again, there's not that dualistic distinction between what's inside history and what's beyond history. Salvation is not something to wait for, but something to be done. It's not only something to be waited for, but something to be done. Another just sort of interesting point is that liberation theology tends to draw its language, the kind of language it uses, from the disciplines of politics and sociology rather than from metaphysics and philosophy. There's a just kind of a different language base that it's drawn from.
Examples of that?
Well, just to talk about when we're talking about liberation rather than salvation. I mean, it's things as simple as that. That it's very much rooted in kind of our understanding of the world rather than in a kind of metaphysical understanding.
When you were down there, did you see a kind of spiritual revival then? I mean, did they go quite hand in hand as the commitments to God and commitment to the social change? Did they march strongly together, or
I think what you did see was very much at the same time this kind of societal renewal, there was very much a strong spiritual renewal as well. Would you say those of you who were there at the time? Yes, Anne.
At the time, and this was even Mexico, uh-huh. We talked about that it felt like seeing the Reformation.
Right.
Because, you know, the priest would stand up there and there would be Bibles in the pews and he was inviting people to read the scripture and talk about it. I mean, it really felt like we were seeing the next generation of what happened at the Reformation of in another location with different just as profound change, but at a different generation.
Exactly. Now, interesting, what's happened in Latin America in the last 10 to 15 years, almost in as a kind of counterpoint to this, as you can imagine, this sort of theological approach was very threatening to many of the powers that be, because it really is called for calling for the toppling of this champagne glass. And so what we've seen in Latin America, at really the impulse and in the support of many of those in power, is a resurgence of a very conservative Christianity, a very evangelical, a very fundamentalistic Christianity, which has very much at its core the support of the status quo, which has a very, a lot of music and a lot of animation, but which does not challenge in any sense. In fact, many of those in power are the ones who have been the strongest advocates and participants in this kind of... So there now has become a new kind of conflict within the church in Latin America between those... not between kind of the old guard. I mean, there is still that. So there are really three wings, you know, the sort of the old line Catholic Church. But between the new, sort of renewed Catholic Church and then a new kind of Protestant fundamentalism that has really gotten very powerful throughout Latin America.
Isn't that otherworldly too?
Yeah, it's also very otherworldly, right? I mean, it's focused on very much on the beyond and the hereafter.
An example in that, we were talking about Latin America and these liberations, all these themes, and then I had one of my people in the congregation kept phoning me. She called me about 7 o'clock every morning. She was watching Robinson's, 500 Club?
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
And they would be interviewing people from Nicaragua, Honduras, and other places that were doing just the opposite, but they were talking about all this revival and all, but it was a totally opposite thing than what we were trying to experience.
Exactly. And it's very confusing for people too, because both for people in there and for us as North Americans, who is the church and what is this all about, and is this really a revival or is it a new form of an old kind of escapist sort of theology? Last point I want to make about theology, and then I want to talk a little bit about what some of the critiques are of liberation theology that I think are important for us to deal with. When it comes to faith, within the framework of liberation theology, faith is not sort of intellectual assent or agreement with doctrine, which it often, you know, it's not supposed to be for us either, but somehow it often comes to that. But an attitude of engagement in the light of God's design with everything human, whether individual, social, economic, political, or educational. Faith is not belief, but obedient participation. Now, you can already see where the critiques are going to come, especially Lutheran critiques of that, right? I mean, yeah. We'll come to that. But this whole notion of obedient participation is kind of central to liberation theology. Now, I want to get into some of the critiques that have been made, but any other comments or questions or points of clarification that you have? To try to understand this better, yes.
Well, I just wondered about that conference.
Medellin?
I won't try to say
no.
it. Were some of the bishops at that, some of them that took this stand toward liberation theology, was among the ones that were assassinated?
Well, some of them were, yes. But it was also many of the conservative bishops that were, I mean, the so-called conservative bishops who One has to recognize that the depth of poverty in Latin America had come to the point that it couldn't be ignored. And I think many of them got carried away with the spirit of the Medellin Conference, and literally was later, many of them, I mean, actually recanted. I mean, they sort of took back what they had said or tried to reinterpret what was being said. But the train was out of the station already, and it was very difficult. I mean, for example, one of the many of those bishops were very, very conservative in their later years. But some of the key ones were Sergio Mendez Arceo from Cuernavaca, Mexico, which is where we've done a lot of our work, and I think some of you have been with us have visited there. Another was Dom Helder Câmara of Brazil. I think that many of you have heard of his little book, The Desert is Fertile, was a very important book. And there were others, and even now, you know, one of the ones who still comes out of that is Samuel Ruiz from Chiapas, Mexico, and you hear of him now because of the struggle in Chiapas. Who's very much involved in the struggle of the indigenous people in Chiapas now, coming very much out of this same sort of theological formation. But many of them who were killed, Archbishop. Interestingly, Archbishop Romero was really not so much part of the Medellin movement, but he was converted later. I mean, he was converted once he became a bishop, and really was transformed as he went out and talked with his priests and met his people, and he couldn't live with the realities he was seeing anymore. He's a Lutheran bishop, right, so he really came out of it again, but he was sort of transformed by his experience because he came out of a very conservative Lutheran church. You know, it had his roots in the Missouri Synod, and the Latin American part of Missouri Synod is very, very conservative in terms of its understanding of social and political reality. So he was really transformed as well. And I think that's one of the keys for liberation theology, is that many of those who later became the leaders and the spokespeople were in fact converted by the poor, were transformed by their experience with the poor. And I think those of you have traveled on this kind of experience, and that we're going to talk about more tomorrow evening, that's the dynamic, right? It's a new understanding of ministry and mission. It's the other way around. It's not us being missionaries in the old traditional sense. Allowed us ourselves to be ministered to by those who live reality every day. And that whole concept of mission we haven't gotten into very much, but that's another important aspect of liberation theology. It turns on its head, I think, some of our traditional understandings of mission and missionaries. Now, as you can imagine, there's been significant reaction to liberation theology, and especially within sort of mainline and particularly Lutheran, from the standpoint of Lutheran theology. One of the critiques that's been, Carl Broughton has made some very, I think, focused critiques on liberation theology, and some of what I'm going to mention today comes from him, but others as well. And let me just highlight some of them. I think some of them could be fairly obvious. One is that liberation theology is an overreaction against the traditional supernatural concept of salvation and otherworldly interpretation of the church's mission. It's an overreaction, and even though salvation includes the social, political, and economic dimensions of life, the individual as individual stands as a naked sinner before God would be the, and that liberation theology doesn't deal with that sort of personal nature of sin and sinner. Now, and I think from the standpoint of traditional theology, that may be a valid criticism, but it also suggests, again, that charge that liberation theology has an ideology underlying it. This also clearly has an ideology underlying it, right? And it has to do with how we see, and it's very much rooted in our own culture, where the notion of the individual is primary. Whereas in Latin America, The individual is not the most important social aspect of social life, but rather the community, or in much of Latin America, the family, right? So that our sort of critique of liberation theology comes out sometimes of our understanding that what's primary, or what's most basic, is the individual. Not all societies share that notion, right? In liberation theology, many critics would argue the gospel represents the ideal state of affairs, which hopefully will come about someday, and for which we ought to fight when this happens. The gospel is no longer a gift, but a demand. And we saw that, you know, I sort of warned you about that coming when we said it's obedient participation, right? The notion, and those of us growing up in the Lutheran Church, this whole notion of how against works righteousness, and yet I think what we have to understand is liberation theology is not saying that you're saved by what you do, but that there again it's this notion of inseparability, that. Faith and action are inseparable. It's not one first and then the other. They're kind of an inseparable reality. The motifs of mystery and divine transcendence become abbreviated or obliterated by reducing God to the dialectics of historical process. That's another critique. That God is somehow, liberation theologians are saying that God is in the process, and that there's not a transcendent dimension. My experience of those who practice and live in faith every day, liberation theology, and one doesn't have to be long in a sort of a worship service to catch the notion that there is clearly a transcendent dimension to those who are adherents to liberation theology. Their concept of God is clearly one that is transcendent, but also very rooted. Again, it's not separate. It's in and around and outside. And
do you think that one reason they maybe can have this? I'm thinking of the rooting and the more mystery and the more transcendence of the Catholic Mass and things like that, that if you superimpose this on that, it becomes more whole, where if we tend, I think we struggle more sometimes. I mean, we have it in our liturgy. But there is, that's so much a part of what is happening. There still is that happening alongside the base Christian communities.
Well, and if you see, I think if you've experienced base Christian communities, a very important aspect of that is prayer and worship. I mean, very much a sense of mystery, of divine transcendence, very very much still a part of the whole spiritual life of people who have made this kind of commitment. And I think that's very true. Another criticism is that sin's definition is blurred in liberation theology. Sin, rather than in a more traditional understanding that sin is a kind of lack of original righteousness which points to a false relationship with God, critics would say elimination of capitalism and disease and poverty does not eliminate sin. And that sin is almost much more seen in terms of sinful structures rather than the individual as sinner before God. And again, I think what we've got here, and we have to constantly be struggling with, that's not, I think there's not a simple road out of that dilemma. But again, it has to do with an understanding of what is the basic element here. Are we talking about purely as an individual, and that we alone are saved, and everybody else has nothing to do with our salvation, or is, are we talking about some kind of more communitarian sort of view of this? Yes?
It just seems to me that there may be a danger in that, but it seems to me that would be very good for the United States Christian community to really take on, because it would do us a whole lot of good to quit worrying so much about individual sin and talk more about the structures in our society that do terrible things.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's precisely what liberation theologians are saying. Yeah. You know, that, and it's that yes, maybe we're pushing the other side, but that kind of corrective is so necessary because of centuries and centuries of the church being in a certain way, right? And I think related to this, and just a last critique, and then I want to open a discussion, there's also this notion that the message of eternal life beyond death is left in a cloud of suspicion in liberation theology. Well, I mean, again, I think within our own church we struggle a lot about what does that mean and what is the nature of life beyond or on the other side of death and all of that sort of thing. And yet, again, in the living out of liberation theology, what happens is that is not the central question. It's as simple as that. I mean, I've heard many people say, you know, I'm not sure what's on the other side. People who are practicing liberation theology. But that's not what I'm living my life for. That sort of goal beyond there, beyond. That what's important is what I'm doing and acting in the world now, not some kind of individual prize beyond death. All right, let me stop there and we have about 6 minutes or so left for any general questions or comments about this. First of all, for those of you that this is somewhat new for, did it give you a feel for it? I mean, do you have a sense of what this animal that called liberation theology is about? Because I hope you at least have an idea. Comments or questions from any of you? I'd love to hear your reactions. Yeah, yeah?
I think one of the liberating things for North Americans about liberation theology is that I think it points out that any theological point of view is not a total way of being able to know God. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are all limited as human beings by being human, and that we can only conceptualize God and God's working in our lives within the limits. Mm-hmm. And to have this strong development of another point of view, and I think to think when you say what are the criticisms of liberation theology, of course, it's a human way of visualizing God's work in the world and in our lives. But I think it's wonderful to be living in a time when there's these two, you know, or more probably, but where these two very strong strengths that kind of work as correctives to each other.
Yeah, good. Yes.
Would you say that one of the criticisms also was that the activism can lead to violent, armed conflict kind of protests?
Right.
That raised great ethical dilemmas for the leaders when the younger persons in the community said, well, the logical consequence of this is that we must fight against the oppressors.
It's absolutely right. And I think there's a great deal of division even within proponents of liberation theology about the role of armed struggle. And I think most would suggest, at least, that we have to have a broader understanding of violence, first of all, that the violence is not simply, some would say the greater violence is the kind of oppression that has been done to people. But nevertheless, that question of the arm, you know, taking up arms, even in defense, and I think how it's mostly interpreted in self-defense, it was a point of struggle and a point of conflict within those who support liberation theology. And and it certainly did emerge into a violent, again, but the question of whose violence, right? I mean, the Contra War, for example, who was being violent and who was, so, but I think you're absolutely right. That's an important question. And I think I also think it would say that liberation theology would not necessarily be reflective of a pacifist theology. By, you know, at least, and I think there are pacifists within liberation theology, but you can't identify the two.
It seems like a lot of the critiques are the establishment looking at the liberation theology position as, you know, looking at the speck in someone else's eye, mm-hmm. and passed along in your own, and that sort of clouding the picture. They see they're not so good, you know, they're really just rejecting the kick status quo.
Right.
Get your eyes off the prize.
Yeah. Yeah, Ellen.
Was this movement of evangelizing Central America, what was that motivated by? It seems...
Well, I think, frankly, I think the... Certainly the Vatican II had opened the door to this. Because of this whole notion of participation of the laity, right?
But I mean the fundamentalists.
Oh, the fundamentalists. Well, I think you saw that. For example, one of the best examples of that is Guatemala. And probably where it really started the most. And I think, and it's, you know, those of you who remember Rios Montt, who was probably one of the worst dictators in Guatemala, very strong evangelical or fundamentalist church, was strong, that the whole thing was strongly promoted by him and those in power in Guatemala because it would precisely help to maintain the status quo. And I think, frankly, in many respects, it was supported by the U.S. government as well as a way of not creating the kind of challenges to authority that the more progressive view of the church did. Yeah.
But one of the largest growing groups of this country among the Latino communities is indeed, in fact, these evangelical groups.
Right.
I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, but in Washington, they're just, I mean, they're right. Sprouting like, you know, wheatgrass, weeds everywhere.
Right.
And my sense is that there is something that is resonating, that is out of that liberation
right.
theology in this evangelical movement. And I'm not quite sure quite what it is, but something is resonating very loudly.
Right.
And it's not an ungenuine movement.
No,
I mean,
that's
you
right.
can't look at it. So I don't think we should romanticize
no.
some of this situation and sort of assume that it was all pie in the sky.
Yeah, right. No.
A lot of stuff. And I think it's... To me, the criticism I have most about liberation theology, it had no sense of forgiveness in it. It really did not have any forgiveness, either on the part of those who participated in it, or a sense of the understanding of the forgiveness of God. You know, and I think that was its peculiar skill.
And it's just interesting thought. Any reaction to that? To that particular comment?
That there was no forgiveness?
Yeah.
Among liberation?
Yeah.
Well, I would not say I couldn't agree with that, but I guess what you brought up, though, and also when you brought up the Reformation, I mean, think of how the Catholic Church was the predominant church for Luther and Reformers, and when you finally take away the structure, which Luther, he split the sacramental structure, no more is marriage a sacrament. No more do I need a mediator between God and myself. If you follow good Lutheran theology, you can wind up with a good atheist argument at the end.
Yeah.
But the point is, when I look at the Russians coming over here, because I'm Russian Orthodox, and the Orthodox Church is fighting against all the evangelicals right now, or the Catholic in the Hispanic places, is those very structures, those very churches were often sided with
the power structure mm-hmm. of the time. And no matter how you want to look at it, when you talk to my Russian immigrant parents, they looked at the structure of the church. Forget it. They love the church. They love the Jesus they know. But don't ever talk about the priest and the structure or the bishops. And in fact, forgiveness was very prevalent in the communities we visited. Yeah. In the sense that there was always this, they never separated from the church, at least in those groups we went into, where they prayed for the conversion of the leaders and the bishops and this and that. So that was very powerful. But that's just a small picture yeah. we saw.
It's an intriguing question, I think, this question of forgiveness, because in one sense, it's one of the places I've experienced the most grace and forgiveness is in the context of those communities. In terms of who I represented and who I was being accepted in spite of that. And also, when I saw some, for example, the way in which those involved in liberation theology called for the treatment of enemies seemed to me a very forgiving, the way that captured prisoners were treated and that sort of thing. But I think it's still a very, very critical question. And I think what you addressed, the strength of the evangelical movement in this country and its impact, I think it has to be examined in the same way. Our time, one more comment, and then we have to...
Well, this is a question. Are there any nuances in how this is lived out among agrarian poor as opposed to urban poor? Or does it sort of feel the same both places? Because I thought the base community sort of were, my concept of it was that it was more agrarian. It was where the priest couldn't be every place, so
it wasn't just in the rural areas. It was some of the stronger workers actually in the urban areas. So I think it had both characters to it very much.
Does it feel different to either place, or is it?
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Not initially, that's not my reaction. I want to just close with a short reflection. Some of you may be familiar with Julia Esquivel, who was a Guatemalan woman. This book, Threatened with Resurrection. She was in exile from Guatemala for many years and did a lot of writing relative to the situation of her people in Guatemala. And there's some wonderful things in here, very, very powerful poems. But this is just a very short one that I want to just close with today, because I think it, again, captures the essence of what liberation theology is about. It's called Hope, Esperanza. In the most obscure and sordid place, in the most hostile and harshest, in the most corrupt and nauseating places, there you do your work. That is why your son descended into hell, in order to transform what is not, and to purify that which is becoming. This is hope. Thank you very much for a good discussion.
You should tell them who published that book, though.
Brethren Press.
The Brethren Press, right.
Exactly.
Just as the irony of it.
Yeah, I know it is, isn't it? Introduction by Rosemary Ruther in here as well. So, good. This is in the library. I'll put it back right now. Thank you all very much.